Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 9th canto, chapter 10, verse 23. Evam Ksipandanusi Sanditam Mutsasraja Banam Savatram Ivatatridayam Viveda So Srikpamam Dasamuke Nyapatat Vimanat Dahiti Jalpati Jane Sukriti Varikta. After thus rebuking Ravana, Lord Ramachandra fixed an arrow to his bow, aimed at Ravana, and released the arrow, which pierced Ravana's heart like a thunderbolt. Upon seeing this, Ravana's followers raised a tumultuous sound, crying, "Alas, alas, what has happened? What has happened?" As Ravana, vomiting blood from his tin mouth, fell from his airplane, just as a pious man falls to earth from the heavenly planets when the results of his pious activities are exhausted. In Bhagavad Gita 9.21, it is said, when the results of their pious activities are exhausted, those who have enjoyed in the heavenly planets fall again to earth. The fruit of activities of this material world are such that whether one acts piously or impiously, one must remain within the material world according to the different conditions. For neither pious nor impious action can relieve one from Maya's clutches of repeated birth and death. Somehow or other, Ravana was raised to an exalted position as the king of a great kingdom with all material opulences. But because of his sinful act of kidnapping Mother Sita, all the results of his pious activities were destroyed. If one offends an exalted personality, especially the supreme personality of Godhead, one certainly becomes most abominable, bereft of the results of pious activities. One must fall down like Ravana and other demons. It is therefore advised that one transcends both pious and impious activities and remain in the pure state of freedom from all designations. Sarvopadi vinirmuktam tatparatvena nirmalam. Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya, 1970. When one is fixed in devotional service, he's above the material platform. On the material platform, there are higher and lower positions. But when one is above the material platform, he's always fixed in the spiritual position. Sagunan samatitya tan brahma buye kalpate, Bhagavad Gita 14.26. Ravana, or those like him, may be very powerful and opulent in this material world, but theirs is not a secure position, because after all, they are bound by the results of their karma. We should not forget that we are completely dependent on the laws of nature. Prakriti kriyamanani guna karmani sarvasa ahankara vimudatma kartahamite manyante. The bewildered spirit soul under the influence of the three modes of material nature thinks himself the doer of activities that are in actuality carried out by nature. Bhagavad Gita 3.27. One should not be proud of one's exalted position and act like Ravana, thinking oneself independent of material nature's laws. Ravana was very powerful. No one could stand up against him. Even great, powerful personalities, great warriors, they failed to defeat Ravana. Even those who were pious and who had performed austerities and thus had received great power, Ravana himself had performed so many austerities, Ravana himself had received so many boons, that in front of Ravana, even those who were pious and had great powers, somehow or other, even they were overwhelmed and subjugated. No one, it seemed that no one could touch Ravana. Of course, it was the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself. it was the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself who had taken it upon himself to dispose the world of Ravana. We recall how the doorkeepers, Jai and Vijay, who were the gatekeepers of Vaikuntha, somehow or other stopped the young Brahmana sages, the four Kumaras, from entering Vaikuntha. And the four Kumaras, being very young, being 5 years of age, just remaining like that and being in that mood, did not appreciate that they were being checked and stopped. And the four Kumaras pointed out that these personalities are not qualified. They're not qualified. They do not have the mentality of residents of Vaikuntha. Their behavior is inappropriate and envious, and therefore they belong in the material world. And they were cursed. Jai and Vijay were cursed to go to the material world. And then, when the Lord personally appeared as a referee in that situation, the word of a Brahmana cannot go in vain. So the word of the four Kumaras had to act. But the question was to the demons, to Jai and Vijay, they were given a choice. Either to appear for 7 births as devotees in the material world, or 3 births as demons. So they chose the birth of demons. Because in that way, they would be shorter in the material world. Rather be demons and be shorter in the material world and then return sooner. So in this way, these personalities were appearing before the Lord. It is said the first time as Hiranyakasipu and Hiranyaksha. It is described that when Hiranyakasipu was killed, that Hiranyakasipu, although he saw the Lord come from the pillar, that he didn't register that he was Vishnu. He just thought, who is this creature? Half man, half lion, coming from the pillar. And he became killed by the Supreme Lord, and therefore he became purified. But the full awareness was not just there as yet. Therefore he appeared again. He appeared again. And Ravana was extremely proud. Ravana was extremely arrogant. Ravana had such a concept of himself. He was thinking, no one can stop me. When Ravana saw the monkey army finally come to Lanka, it is described that there was one Maha Ogre of monkeys. A Maha Ogre, I wouldn't know how to pronounce it in any other way, is a one with 64 zeros. So it's an impressive number. I mean, whatever in Western mathematics, I have no idea how to pronounce such a number. 1 to the 64th, one Maha Ogre. So there was a serious number of monkeys. And Ram looked at those monkeys and thought, okay, let me first... Ravana looked at those monkeys and thought, okay, I'll first get rid of those monkeys and then I'll kill Ram. How could he even conceive of killing that many monkeys? But that was something... He wasn't even thinking about it. It was an obvious thing that he would do in this way. Ravana had a conception of himself, of being so great. So finally, when Ravana was killed by Lord Ramachandra, still he couldn't fully appreciate, due to his own sense of self-aggrandizement, he could not actually admit the glories of Ram. So although he was killed by Ram, it sort of was a surprise. It was something beyond expectation, in a way. It didn't fully dawn upon him. And therefore, one more time, he came back and was killed again by Krishna, when actually, at that time, he came to the full understanding of, yes, I have been killed by the Supreme Lord. And he was freed from any trace of demoniac mentality. So it says something about Ravana's mentality. Although Ravana had been, at times, been defeated, there was a time when Ravana began to feel the pressure, as we also saw. When Ravana began to realize that this is not just an easy victory. When Ravana began to think of allies and support. When Ravana turned to anyone he could turn to, and he turned to Bali Maharaj, because Bali Maharaj was in the family lineage of the Daityas, of the demons, after all. Bali Maharaj, who had once been captured by Ravana and so on, but then who had received a benediction after pleasing the Lord, Bali Maharaj was now living in great opulence in a palace, and Ravana was personally standing guard at that palace. So Ravana thought, let me go there and let me ask him to help. So he went to Bali Maharaj and he asked Bali Maharaj if he would please help in the battle. And Bali Maharaj, he said that, now I am old, I've become too old, I just will not fight personally anymore. But if I can help you in some way, I surely will. After all, you are in our lineage, so I can give you some support. You come with me. So Ravana followed him through the palace and they came to a chamber. And in that chamber there was a huge mountain of gold. So Bali Maharaj said to Ravana, you can have that. I can have that whole mountain of gold. All of it. Yes, yes, you take it. So then Ravana was overwhelmed in ecstasy. This is better than I thought it would be. And he was trying to... Bali Maharaj says, yes, you take it. And Ravana tried to take it and he couldn't move it. Then Bali Maharaj asked him and said, have a good look at this mountain of gold. What does it look like? And Ravana looked and he said, it looks like a giant earring. And Bali Maharaj said, yes, that's right. This is the earring of Hiranyakasipu. And he was defeated by the Supreme Lord. And now you are going to try, and you cannot even lift his earring. Return, Sita. And in this way, practically everyone advised Ravana to return Sita. Not only Vibhishana, but also Kumbhakarna. And Kumbhakarna spoke even stronger than Vibhishana. Because who could say anything to Kumbhakarna? Kumbhakarna was such a character. He was Ravana's brother who had also performed great, great austerities. And Kumbhakarna had a voracious appetite. And he was ready to devour the whole universe. And he asked for unlimited power. So finally, the goddess of speech, Saraswati, entered. She, upon the order of Indra, entered into his tongue. Right? And when he asked for a benediction, I can't remember verbatim because I haven't done my homework of the sentence, to be honest. She entered into the speech, and the Sanskrit word, the meaning of the Sanskrit word changed simply by changing one syllable, and the whole meaning changed, and it became that he got a benediction that he would sleep. So like, well, this is not fair. This is not fair. That was not his aim. So finally a compromise was reached that he would sleep for 6 months and be awake for 6 months. And during those 6 months he was awake, he would devour enormous quantities. In fact, for the battle, they woke him up before time. And it was extremely difficult to wake him up before time. They had to bring... It's a battle afterwards. We have to... It has to get a little dramatic sometimes. So, they brought huge quantities of flesh and dead animals and put it close to his mouth. He was a huge personality. And it was lying there, but he was in total sleep. They tried everything. They tried to make huge amounts of noise next to his ears. Nothing would wake him up. Eventually they made a fire on his chest. And as the fire on his chest was burning, at one point he opened an eye. And he saw all these men who were throwing more and more logs in the fire on his chest. And he ate them on the spot. He ate all these rakshasas right there and then. And then finally he woke up and ate all the piles of flesh and so on. Kumbhakarna was a monster, really. When he was on the battlefield, he just devoured the monkeys in a huge form he took on the battlefield. And he was just able to devour. Because he did not always have that huge form. Because these rakshasas had many mystic powers, and he was able to take that form and take a smaller form at will. So when he was sitting in the court counseling to Ravana, he did not have that enormous form. But on the battlefield, he grew to an enormous size. But only Hanuman was able to match it. Because Hanuman also could grow in size. No problem. So Hanuman also took an enormous size. But anyway, Kumbhakarna made terror. But Kumbhakarna was convinced, in spite of his great power, that they were going to lose the war. He had no doubt about it. Only Ravana had this foolish conviction, which stayed with him till the end. When all the warriors were losing, it got worse and worse. When Hanuman first came and caused havoc in Lanka as the advance party who came to meet Sita and bring the ring of Ram and to reassure Sita that rescue was near. At that time, the royal guard caught Hanuman, and it became a whole thing, and Hanuman fought back and killed so many personalities, and they brought reinforcement, and a powerful general was killed by Hanuman, and then of course they captured him, and then they set his tail on fire, and with that Hanuman burned down half of Lanka, and then went back. So Hanuman had caused great damage, had killed a very powerful hero, had killed many other powerful warriors. So for that reason, Hanuman was indeed considered a great threat. A great threat. An army was coming of monkeys. So they were thinking a whole army of these guys is serious. But as various personalities became defeated, as Kumbhakarna became defeated. It seemed inconceivable. But Kumbhakarna was killed. How was it possible that even Kumbhakarna was killed? That was something that Ravana just couldn't compute. But then, okay, then Indrajit came out. And Indrajit, his son, he was extremely powerful. He had defeated Indra. And Indrajit was proceeding in a very intelligent way. Indrajit was worshipping. Indrajit was gaining strength in battle, not only on the strength of previous austerity and skill, but furthermore, Indrajit was adding to it by puja. And he performed all these pujas which added to his power. So Indrajit had an approach which was very difficult to deal with. And therefore Indrajit comes out as the most powerful warrior of all Ravana's warriors, even more powerful than Kumbhakarna. And Indrajit then was the one who managed to shoot Lakshman. He got some benediction from Brahma. So in order to honor that, Lakshman let himself be shot and fall unconscious. But he was able to injure Lakshman to a point where Lakshman lay semi-dead on the ground. And then, of course, Hanuman is supposed to bring that healing herb and can't find it. This mirchu sajivani, that which brings even the dead back to life. And then Hanuman shows his spirit of servitorship, that he will not be stopped by any opposition, and that somehow or other it must be done. And then Hanuman brings the mountain. He brings the whole mountain. When he cannot find the herb, he brings the whole mountain. And here we see in Hanuman that mood from not giving up in devotional service, not coming to the point where it is too much. No, now I cannot do it anymore. No. Whatever the obstacle was, Hanuman would rise to the occasion and find a way. And that great determination, Hanuman is often depicted as flying and carrying the mountain. His fame, that's one of the moments of great fame of Hanuman. It's like his fame is depicted in him carrying the mountain, showing how much he is he's not holding back in any way. He'll do anything and everything in the service of Lord Brahmacharya. But somehow or other, even after more and more powerful personalities were killed in the battle, it still didn't dawn upon Ravana. It still didn't register that he was going to be defeated. He just thought that somehow or other, this Ram is powerful. Well, there's no doubt about it. He's powerful. And of course, by trick and treacherous means, right, he defeated these powerful warriors, actually against the odds, right? Against the odds. It wasn't in fair fight, obviously. Yeah. Somehow or other. But even all that never ever brought Ravana to the point that he thought that he was going to be defeated. And because of his enormous self-confidence, the Rakshasas also, they had this idea, there is no one in the world who can stand up against Ravana. There is no one. He is the most powerful personality in the whole world. He is the most opulent. He is just the one personality who is the supreme in this world. And that's how it is. Tunnels to South America, Prabhupada said, from where gold was brought. And Prabhupada said that Ram and Lakshman were in South America. And he said so when he was in Brazil. He said Ram and Lakshman were here. That is interesting. The Brazilian devotees, the local GBC, told me, he said, there is a tunnel here. And he said, this tunnel is so deep. He said, nobody knows where it ends. He said, the army went in there with oxygen, but they had to return. They had to return. No one has gone to the end of this tunnel. Some have tried, but no one has returned. Any adventurous people here can explore it and check it out. We'll give you the address of the tunnel. So the devotees, of course, say, that's the tunnel, that's the one, that's it. That's the one, that's the tunnel. Yeah. Whatever the tunnel may be, tunnels were there, there's no doubt. And we also read that Ravana's brother, Mohi Ravana, was residing there in South America, in that part of the world. And that he had captured Ram and Lakshman, and that he wanted to sacrifice them, and that he had an underground fort which was under a lake which had lotuses in it, and one of these lotuses was the entrance gate to the fort. It was a very difficult thing. It's a very long story, the Mohi Ravana story, which we will not tell today. But somehow or other, Mohi Ravana was hard to kill, that much we will say. He was hard to kill. Because his life was kept outside his body. There were seven flames in a cave that had to be put out, and simultaneously one would have to shoot him in the heart. And then one could kill Mohi Ravana. So that was difficult, very difficult. And Hanuman was ordered by Lord Ramachandra to put out the flames at a certain time, to find these flames, put them out at a certain time. And at that same time, Ram was supposed to be sacrificed. And he had chosen this particular time. And as a last wish, Mohi Ravana asked him if he had a last wish. Ram said, yes, because I am a Kshatriya, I want to die with an arrow in my hand. Then at the exact moment, Ram threw the arrow. He threw it into the heart of Mohi Ravana. And then Lakshman had to put out the flames. So Hanuman had to put out the flames. He put out one flame and put out another one, and then the first one came back up again. And he didn't know what to do. But Vayu, his father, assisted. And Vayu created a vacuum. Then all the seven flames went out. The arrow pierced the heart. Mohi Ravana also died. So there were many, the Ramayana, it has so many extensive stories. The main story being Sita, who is Ram's wife, kidnapped by Ravana, and then a huge battle to gain Sita back. But within that story, there are endless sub-stories, and stories within stories, and everything is a story. It starts already in the very beginning, before the birth of Ram, that Dasarath, king of Ayodhya, living in this amazing, wonderful palace, which was extremely opulent, with multi-stories and beautiful decorated towers, gold-capped and wonderful terraces with balustrades, very ornate, and there, Dasarath was looking out over his kingdom. And Dasarath went down to the royal assembly hall. And as he entered the royal assembly hall, there was a man seated next to the door with a huge drum of like a diameter of 2 meters and long sticks. And he was beating the drum at the rhythm of the strides of the king. Boom, boom. And the king entered the royal assembly, and everyone stood up and received him. And there were sages, there were brahmanas, there were ministers, there were all kinds of personalities. Then Dasarath sat on the royal throne and to the assembly brought out one point, and that point was his personal grief at the fact that he didn't have a son. And then a whole discussion how he could actually get a son. And then it all comes out that somehow or other a sacrifice had to be performed by Rishyasringa. Rishyasringa is a very interesting personality. Because Rishyasringa was the son of a great sage who somehow or other grew up in a forest as a brahmachari, completely as a brahmachari. And very much so, his father was extremely powerful, and his father had arranged it that in that forest there was no female presence at all. Even amongst the animals, there were only male birds, only male deers and male boars, no females at all. Even amongst the plants, right? There was just zero female influence in that forest. And Rishyasringa, in his whole life, had just never seen any female influence whatsoever. So he was hardcore brahmachari. There's no other word for it. He was like hardcore, the real thing. Like they don't make him anymore. And, well, what shall we say? So then, somehow or other, Romapat, a neighboring king, also had to perform a sacrifice, and he was the one who brought out Rishyasringa. And they did it via a trick. Somehow or other, they invited his father to go somewhere for some sacrifice, and then the son was alone. And then what they did, they dressed up this beautiful girl as a brahmachari in deer skin and everything, like, you know, put her on a raft down the river and make her sing bhajans. So our young brahmachari was very happy to finally get some association from another brahmachari, although this was an unusual brahmachari from a faraway place. You know, they're different over there. But somehow or other, whatever transpired between those two, it showed that instinct goes beyond culture, and that brahmacharya is ultimately a culture. It is ultimately a cultivation of a consciousness, and that it is not like intrinsic and inherent to the human nature. And that the fundamental attraction between male and female was stronger than that whole training and conditioning as a brahmachari. And Rishyasringa somehow or other went down. And before he knew it, he was out of the forest, married and all. Well, his father had to be pacified, and that was done also. Anyway, then Rishyasringa was still, because of his previous tapasya and his purity, the appropriate person to perform a sacrifice for Maharaj Dasarath, And in that sacrifice, a personality appeared with payas, with the with a sweet rice, not ordinary, but which had potency, and it was divided amongst the wives of Dasarath, who then conceived. So, like this, the Ramayana is full of these kind of stories, bringing out all kinds of issues and points. You know, like here, the brahmacharya issue is looked at, and how no brahmachari can ever think he is rising above the influence of material nature. No matter how strong the cultivation is, the influence of the material nature remains. And through brahmacharya, one cannot overcome the pushing of the senses. Through austerity or any form of sense control, it is not possible. That is the conclusion. So in this way, the Ramayana is full of these subsidiary points. Another point we may see in the sage Vishvamrita. The sage Vishvamrita. Vishvamrita was a king, and Vishvamrita as a king once came upon Vasistha. And Vasistha was a great sage who had a kamadenu, a wish-fulfilling desire cow. And when the king saw that cow, he said, "Give me that cow. I want that cow." So no. And then he took the cow by force. But Kamadenu was getting very upset and called out for shelter to Vasistha. And then, you know, although the king had brought a very powerful army, Vasistha simply threw his staff on the ground and created like an army that was more powerful than the one of Vishvamrita, and he was hopelessly defeated. So then Vishvamrita got into the mood from, "I don't want to be a Kshatriya anymore. I don't like this game anymore. I want to be a Brahmana. I want to be." So he began to perform great austerity, and for extreme austerities, and gradually by these austerities he got different benedictions. At one point Brahma appears before him and says, "Now you are recognized as a rishi." Yes, as a rishi. "Does this mean that I am powerful like Vasistha?" "No, Vasistha is a Brahma rishi." So he continued to perform austerity. "Does this mean that I will be able to control my senses?" No, it doesn't mean that, but you are a rishi. So then he performed more austerity. He became a Maharishi. Then the demigods became worried and sent Menaka, ankle bells, and still he could not control his senses. And he fell down with Menaka for a long time and then came to his senses. Then again, he performed austerity and he became extremely powerful, but again they sent a heavenly damsel, this time Ramba, surrounded with Cupid together. And he became so angry that he cursed them and said again he couldn't control his mind. Again, he still could not control his anger. So then after that, more austerity. Finally, he became a Brahma Rishi. Then he could control the pushings of the senses, the pushings of the mind, the pushings of anger. Finally. But all through great austerity. But then his austerity was tested again. There was one king who had been cursed. This king was a fool because he wanted to go in his material body to heaven. He liked his own body so much. He didn't want to give it up. So he just wanted to go in this very same body to the heavens. Yes. And a spiritual master rejected him. Was for sister actually would not wouldn't entertain him. So this is foolishness. But then indirectly, Godson approached the sons, that who cursed him that he would become a chandala. So he became like as a chandala. He looked horrible, got ugly. But anyway, then he came to Vishwamrita and he asked Vishwamrita for shelter. And Vishwamrita said, "All right, I will send you there to the heavenly place in your chandala body." And he just, and then, you know, like, this chandala started to rise up into the sky, going up and up and up. And when Indra saw that, he said, like, "What's he doing here? He's an offender of the spiritual master." Down. So Indra cast him down. And again, Vishwamrita lifted him back up, and then he created his own heaven. He created a copy. And in there he started to create his own Indra and so on. So Indra gets, "Oh, stop, stop, stop. This is not good. This is going to create all kinds of trouble. All right, he can stay where he is. Let him stay there." So he became a star. He became very effulgent. And he became a star who is still there now. So like that. But then it is described in the Ramayana, and that is interesting, is that Vishwamrita then, in that action, exhausted all the result of his austerity. And then he had to perform more austerity again to build up new power. So we have often heard this about this point that that a great sage, you know, touched the disciple and gave all his power, transferred it all to the disciple. Like it's said about Ramakrishna, who gave all his power to Vivekananda and then said, "And now I have nothing left. I've given everything." And Prabhupada used to kind of joke about that. Or Prabhupada used to dismiss that as this has nothing to do with real spiritual realization. So we see here the difference between the power that is obtained from some form of austerity, a form of mystic power, and how such mystic power can become exhausted. We see that. That's all he gained, was mystic power. It cannot compare to true spiritual power, because true spiritual power has nothing to do with building up strength, but has everything to do with grace and with pleasing the Supreme Lord. So looking at the story of Vishwamrita, we see that ultimately his whole focus was on building up his own strength through austerity and building up his own mystic power and mystic strength, which ultimately fell short. So another point in the Ramayana is this, is that any attempt to attain mystic power will fall short. The only thing, the only power that is unlimited is the power that comes from the Supreme Lord. Srila Prabhupada described that as the monkey way and the cat way, and how the monkey, with its own little hands, the little monkey holds on to its mother. The kitten, though, is being lifted by the superior strength of its mother. Prabhupada said the cat way is better than the monkey way in spiritual life. When we try to elevate ourselves by becoming more and more powerful, we may become very powerful, but still, it is limited. But when we are going the cat way and take shelter of the Supreme Lord, he is unlimited in power and can supply unlimited power to his devotee. So that point is being highlighted in that pastime. So in this way we see various points highlighted. Yesterday I shortly mentioned the story of the bear. The noble bear that the story that Sita told, and for those who missed it, I'll tell it very quick now. Hunter hunting in the forest, comes across a tiger. Suddenly, the hunter is no longer the hunter. The tiger becomes the hunter. On the heels of the hunter, hunter runs for his life, climbs to the tree, goes up the tree, finds a bear. Finds himself between a bear and a tiger. Then the tiger begins to speak. Tiger says to this bear, "See that man? He's a hunter, a mutual enemy. Kick him down." The bear says, "No, I cannot do. He is my guest. He's come to my home. I must give him protection." Then the tiger speaks to the hunter and says, "You see that bear? If you kick him down instead, I will eat him instead of you." The hunter doesn't hesitate, kicks the bear. The bear goes down, grabs a branch, and sort of saves his life at the last minute, climbs back up, comes up, and then the tiger speaks again to the bear and says, "Look at that man. Look at that man. You gave him shelter and he betrayed you. Kick him down before he does it again." "No," the bear says, "his misbehavior doesn't justify that I will misbehave as well. He still came to my home. He's still my guest. I must give him shelter." So this noble bear, it is Sita who's telling the story to Hanuman. So it is interesting because Hanuman is the embodiment of Dharma. And Hanuman is not just an uncultured personality, as we remember. When Hanuman met Lord Ramachandra the first time, Hanuman did it in a very cultured way. Spoke to the Lord not only the right words, but even on the right note. He even knew what note he had to speak on. So refined is Vedic culture. So Hanuman was extremely refined and highly educated and cultured. And yet, we see that Sita was still more refined. Sita was still more refined in her judgment and in how she dealt with the situation and how she applied Dharma. So we see this amongst devotees. We see similar dynamics amongst the Pandavas. You see how, like, Bhima is a pure devotee, and so is Arjuna, and so are the others, the twins, and so is Yudhisthira. But it is Yudhisthira. It is Yudhisthira who again and again, right, is the man who has the greatest vision. Yeah. They're all pure devotees. But Bhima sometimes, Bhima sometimes would like to take the law in his own hand, right? Yes. Bhima sometimes would just like to personally fix Duryodhana. And then there's that story how the Pandavas are coming, are in the forest for so many years, 12 years now. So they've been and in those 12 years, Duryodhana has been ruling. So Duryodhana has become very established and very glorious. And one day Karna comes and says, "I have a great idea." "Oh yes, my dear Karna, please. What is it?" He said, "Spies have told me the whereabouts of the Pandavas, where they are in the forest. And then I got this great idea that why don't we go there with a royal procession and just show them our glory, just to rub it in a little bit." It's a great idea, Duryodhana. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Oh, yeah, wonderful. So everything was arranged, and all the queens were there, and everyone decked out in their best on the most beautiful chariots and ready to go. And everything was great. Then, as they came close to the place where the Pandavas were hiding, there was a lake. And they came past that lake. Suddenly this Gandharva comes out of the lake. And this Gandharva says to Duryodhana, "Stop." "Stop? What do you mean, stop?" It's like, "Stop. No one can go past here. Look, you're one And I've got a huge army here, you know what I mean? With the biggest heroes. Get out of my way, okay? And it becomes a huge fight, and a serious fight. And it's all Gandharva army fighting with the army of Duryodhan, and it's a hell of a fight. And the rumor, the news spreads very quick, so when the Pandavas hear about it, Bhima goes, this is great, this is great. These Gandharvas are saving us a great job, you know. Hey, well done. Right? This is something should have been done long ago. And then, you know, Yudhisthira is just in the middle of a sacrifice. And Yudhisthira says to his brother, he says that, no. He said, for the world, for amongst us, there are Kurus and Pandavas. But for the world, we are all Kurus. We are all Kurus. We are family. He says, they, outsiders, are attacking our family. It is our duty. It is our duty to come to their rescue. And Bhima looks at him like, we? Rescuing Duryodhan? And then, the funny thing is that the other Pandavas the same. Arjuna looks at him, nah, you're not serious. Huh? This is a joke. You're not like serious. No, we should go. And then Yudhisthira says, but I cannot go because I'm in the middle of this sacrifice, so I can. So you guys go. So then that's even too much, you know. I mean, he wants to say that he's not even going. And they, you know, have to go against their will. Huh? But they're going. They're going. And then Arjuna saves Duryodhana. Huh? So you can see how it works, how amongst the Pandavas, although they're all pure devotees, how Yudhisthira has this greater vision of pure devotion. And it is like that. Huh? It is like that. That the same we see in Sita. Huh? She is the visionary. She has greater vision, more refined vision than Hanuman. And so in this way, there is this story shows the nature of spiritual hierarchy. And that even if all are pure devotees, still we are not equal. Still, this communist spirit, you know, is like, you know, you are no better than I am, kind of thing, you know. Down with the Tsar. Anyway, it was a shot in. What can be said? The Bolsheviks. and all that. Yes, that spirit, that you are no better than I am. That spirit. We are all equal. That doesn't exist in spiritual life. Although there is Pandita Samadarshina, that we are all equal spirit souls. But yet, everyone, there is a hierarchy, there is a spiritual hierarchy. And we see this in the Ramayana, we see this also in the Mahabharata. We see it everywhere. And that is something that is not part of our culture. We're not used to that. Yeah. We're not used to that. There's very much this tendency as like, you know, hey, don't think you're any better than me, okay? Alright, you got it? You know? Yeah. That's very deeply rooted in our conditioning. But in spiritual life, it is the opposite. Yes, you are better than me. Yes. And I depend on you. So this mood of dependence on the judgment of superiors is very much there in the Ramayana, in Hanuman. And in this way, Hanuman is glorious. On his own, Hanuman is not glorious. He cannot be glorious. Even although he is educated, even although he is a devotee, even although he is advanced, even although he goes to any extent to please the Lord, still he is dependent on on the vision of superiors, on guidance. He's dependent. So this is a law of spiritual life. And everyone remains dependent. Remains dependent on the Supreme Lord and His representatives. And somehow or other, therefore, it is said, he who is the greatest servant becomes the greatest master. Or as Lord Chaitanya said, that never is there a time when one becomes the master in chanting Hare Krishna. Now, I've practiced this bhakti yoga for so many years. I've mastered the art. Bhakti yoga, mantra master.
Fine.
Mantra master. But there is no such title, you know, like no black belt in chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. I'm so sorry. Jeez, you know. There is no black belt. It's simply, Lord Chaitanya said that I never became the master in chanting the holy name. I always remained a servant of the holy name. So somehow or other, depending on the holy name, depending on Krishna, depending on Krishna's devotees, depending on the spiritual master, depending on the Vaishnavas, depending on the senior Vaishnavas, always seeing that if someone is senior, he has the blessings of the Lord. For some reason, there is some reason that this person is senior, that he got some blessings, something. So for some reason, for a divine reason, he got prominence. So in this way, one always looks for a spiritual hierarchy. Well, that's another point I just want to draw out of the Ramayana. I cannot, obviously, in one lecture, do the whole Ramayana. I have tried, not tonight, but in the past, in previous Ram Navamis, I have done a dramatic lecture going through the whole thing, right? And that can take up to 3 hours, and then of course one has to cut many corners and so on, because it can also go for 3 days or 30 days or for 3 years or 3 lives. One can spend his whole life in digging into the details of the Ramayana. So now I just took a few points, highlighting a few points which I think are meaningful to us. And with that, I will turn it over to you for your responses. Yes? Yeah, okay.
I would just like to add, Brazil, they have an ancient name of the land, and that is Pindurama.
Pindurama.
Every city has a street name like
that. Pindurama. Yeah. The glories of Lord Ram are widely spread, and we find in so many places, we find influence of the name of Lord Ramachandra. Of course, Thailand and Indonesia. There is such a wonderful culture in Indonesia. Still in Java, they have this very beautiful Shiva temple, a very famous, beautiful, enormous temple, something like Angkor Wat in Cambodia. And there, they annually are performing the Ramayana in that temple. And it's really something to go to. And I've just been looking at it on the internet, at like photos of that. And I just decided today, I found that last night, actually, and I decided that I will go there 1 year to just see the Ramayana therapy. They also have in Indonesia this Cetak dancing, right? And it's really something, you know, you see all these people. Well, there's this movie which shows various religious things in the world, and it shows the Cetak dance, and it shows this old Indonesian man like with a face like, and he gets into it, and he makes noises like, and then you see people all around him divided in two groups, and they all start to make convulsions, and then they start to like go like this. Hundreds of them, like, all together, you know, and you're looking at this, what is this, some sort of cult, you know? I mean, it's like they're going into a trance, you know, some sort of religious fervor, right? And if you're looking at it, that's us. Actually, that's us, that's our culture, because it's the Ramayana, it's the battle. It's the whole battle. It's the monkey army right there. And you're looking at these guys. And he's a Rambhakta. He's a Rambhakta. So in this way, you know, that's Indonesia. Some amazing, amazing elements of culture in dramatically showing the Ramayana. We should go. I think so. It's worth it. And, you know, so everywhere, in New Zealand, you have all these kind of places, Rama Rama. Mm-hmm. There's a town called Rama Rama. Everywhere is Rama in New Zealand. Wherever you go, Rama, Rama, Rama this, Rama that, Rama Rama. All over the place. So yes, the influence of Lord Ramachandra has been very widely spread all over the world, without a doubt. Without a doubt. And, although our focus is Krishna, this day, Ram Navami, is considered one of the most important days in the year for us. Srila Prabhupada stressed that. He pointed out Gaur Purnim, of course, Nityananda's appearance day, Ram Navami, Nrisimha Chaturdasi, and Krishna Janmashtami. These are like our major festivals. These are the principal festivals. So Prabhupada emphasized Ram Navami as a principal festival, and we must also understand that although we spend our time with Krishna, and Krishna is of course so unlimited, we have our hands full trying to understand Krishna's nature and pastimes and teachings and so on. But still, we must absorb the essence of Lord Ramachandra's teachings. Therefore, in Bhagavatam, it's there. The essence is there in the Bhagavatam. Although the story is given in a shortened version, the essential points are there. And we must absorb that spirit of sacrifice that Lord Ramachandra had. You know? Not my feelings, my desires, or my needs, my psychophysical, psychopathic tendencies. No, to hell with it all. Just the higher principle, the higher goal comes first. Sacrifice for the ideal standard. That spirit of sacrifice. You see it in no one. Like in Lord Ramachandra. So that's that we have to absorb, that we need also in our Krishna consciousness. And of course, Prabhupada was asked, you know, like the Rama in the Hare Krishna Mahamantra, who's it referring to? Some were saying it's Balaram, some saying it's Lord Ramachandra, and the truth, and big debate, and Prabhupada finally said, both. It's both. All included. So Lord Ramachandra. So we're chanting the name of Lord Ramachandra all the time. All the time. So he's very close to us. Very close to us. Dharma is very important to us. Sacrifice for the higher, higher goals. Okay. Yeah, Lajabati. No. Why don't you try and ask the first question, Mandy?
With the said that Ravana has 10 heads and they kind of could not be, he could not be killed even by cutting off all the heads because he has some nectar in his heart. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And he represents lust. And kind of lust is like that, it comes again, like you manage to suppress it and it comes back again. But somehow or another, Lord Ramachandra appears in his heart. There was some blessing of the sage. I don't remember the story exactly, but is it like, and you mentioned about Brahmacharya, that Brahmacharya is a culture, but still it's not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Can you mention something about that?
That's all simple, right? The bottom line is, nothing is good enough except when we take shelter in devotional service in the lotus feet of the Lord. It's the only thing that will work. Nothing else will work. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Not even worth trying. Not even worth thinking about. Not even considering. Nothing's going to work. Only pure devotional service to the lotus feet of the Lord. Kechit kevalai bhakti vasudev parayana. Only to be absorbed in Krishna. It's the only thing. It takes many births. Bhavanam jamalante gyanavam mampapada vasudev samamante. Only after many, many births are you coming to that point to accept that Vasudev is there. Yeah.
You mentioned the strong connections between Kurus and Pandavas when they were in trouble. I have a question about Gotra. You mentioned in one of your classes that you can say that my father is Mr. John, or you can say that my father is Padmanabha Swami, for example.
Uh-huh.
And it has the same quality or the same significance.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is that if one pure devotee can liberate, let's say, seven generations or whatever from his family, if the Gotra, the spiritual Gotra has the same quality, and the guru, the spiritual master, is also a pure devotee, what are the dynamics in that relationship towards his disciples?
Well, okay. You're referring to a point that in the Vedic culture, that gotra or family lineage is considered to be important, basically they are tracing back one's family origins to the mental sons of Lord Brahma. And families of high standing, either Brahmin families or Kshatriya families, can still do so. And then even other families might have long-standing traditions and can trace it back to some sage and so on. Mm. And anybody who doesn't have, who cannot trace out his family lineage, is either a sudra or a jat, right? An aboriginal, that a casteless person. So that is Vedic culture. But Srila Prabhupada explained that we can claim that we are achyuta gotra, that we have that connection with Krishna, and it's a spiritual lineage, right? And it's achyuta gotra. It's the infallible family lineage. It is the perfect family lineage. Yes. Now that was not just Srila Prabhupada's idea, because when I was temple president in India, right, at that time, in legal documents in India, if you buy some property or something like that, then when my identity is stated in the legal document, then they will not just give my name, but they would give father's name, right? So to indicate my gotra. Right? But instead of father's name, they can give the name of the spiritual master. Yeah? And that counts as good as. Right? So in legal documents in India, they accept that. Yeah? The name of the guru as the identification of the gotra. So that's very nice that so much Vedic culture still is there in India today that they recognize that. That's quite nice. I mean, I was impressed by that. But ultimately, our lineage is spiritual, Achyuta Gotra. So you don't have to worry about seven generations being delivered or this or that. The essence is Achyuta Gotra. There's the infallible connection with Krishna. And therefore, it's the infallible Gotra. It's not Krishna Gotra. It's Achyuta Gotra. Achyuta means the infallible lineage. Yeah. We are in the Achyuta Gotra.
And if they ask you to prove it?
Prove it? A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, and then just go back. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, then go back. And then go come to Madhvacharya, and then go back to Vyas, go back to Narada and Brahma and Krishna. So, any more details required? Okay, we can supply. Please read these books. Here they are. Kavi Karnapur's, Gaura Ganadish, Deepika, you can read. You can read the Pramaya Ratnavali from Baladev Vijayabhusan. You can see what Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said about it. Want any more? Want biographies of all these personalities? Yes, no problem, we can supply them. But you must be ready to read. So, no problem. Prabhupada was like that, not so easily intimidated. When they were taking the movement in the United States to court on brainwashing charge, Prabhupada then, Adi Keshava was fighting the case and he was getting very worried. The court is asking for evidence. And where are we going to get evidence now? Prabhupada said, deposit the Bhagavatam in the court. Deposit the whole Bhagavatam and says, this is our evidence. Yes. So Prabhupada is like that, It's like not easily intimidated and ready. Yes, we have our evidence. Here it is. So, come. You want to question the Sampradaya Gotra? No problem. Come and question our Gotra. You'll have the evidence. No problem. Achyuta Gotra. Of course, if you go to Jagannath Puri to the temple, they will not accept it. But we will also not accept them. They can be told that actually their gotras are broken. Because the sanskaras, the Vedic Brahmanas depend on sanskaras, but the Vedas are lost. Only 6%, at the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur is writing that at his time only 6% of Vedic literature was still available. And therefore, the Brahmanas did not have the proper scripture anymore to perform all the sanskaras. Therefore, amongst the Vedic Brahmanas, the gotra has been broken long ago. So the only gotra that really stands is the Achyuta Gotra. So, enough for the gotra business. We are commemorating Lord Ramachandra today, and we thank the actors for bringing it out, Lord Ramachandra and Sugriva. With his serious monkey face. We appreciate Ravana looking extremely heavy. He did a good job. Yeah, he looked really... And Hanuman with his friendly smile.
Queen Ramachandra. That's very nice. We thank you. We thank the Stockholm devotees for always doing these plays on appearance days. I think it's something something of the culture of this temple, which is, or this yantra, which is a great bonus. I don't think anywhere else I see so much seriousness in the place. It's becoming a meditation for all of us, and I think it's a very valuable service, and I hope your dramas will continue, go deeper and deeper, and that all the actors will get more and more absorbed in the roles and already start preparing for the next play and reading up to it so they can absorb the mood and just, and then we'll see. We'll see what comes out of next. Thank you very much. Shri Shri Ramachandra ki
Jai.
Shri Ram Nami Maha Mahotsava ki
Jai.
Go, everybody.